Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, Jam, and with me as always are Nick, Becca, and Mark.
Hey.
Hello.
Hello. So before we get into it, Nick, do we have any new patrons?
Yes, I want to give a shout out to Leper One, who recently became a new patron, as well as Nick, who recently became a patron and then upgraded to the Iconic tier and was able to join us for our Iconic patron game, which happened yesterday and was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and Becca ran her first Iconic patron game and it went fantastic. So
we all survived.
That's right. Well, we have a great show for you this week. We are going to do our review of Overworld and Beyond by Dread Unicorn Games. So this is by Ashley Law and John Marvin, and so we're just going to get into it. There's a lot here. So as with all of our reviews of adventures, there will be spoiler content. As all of our reviews of Ashley's adventures, that may not matter because your GM may choose a different path. But we're getting into it right now. So yeah, if you don't want to be spoiled, don't listen to this episode. Go listen to one of our other fantastic episodes, but this is your last chance. So Overworld and Beyond was kickstarted last year, and it was laid out as kind of not the manual of the planes, but a series of planar adventures. And as the stretch goals got unlocked, more things got added. So we're just going to do our standard Iconic style review where we go through each chapter, give you the highlights, give you what we liked about it, and hopefully get done in under 45 minutes. There's a lot in here, so let's just jump in. The opening chapter is the Caro Hills, which at first blush may seem a bit out of sync with a book on the plains because it is an amazing sandbox for the adventurer tier. There are planar things going on there. Mark, do you want to kind of give us an overview of the Caro Hills? I know you really enjoyed this section.
Yeah, I did. There's three small towns, and you can set them anywhere in your world or if you're running Dragon Empire. We have Shank, Shriveport, and Harrowbridge. And why we're starting in some towns along a coast is the veil between planes in this area is thin. So a lot of magicians, sorcerers, wizards, and such like Harrowbridge because they can reach out and touch the other planes, contact them, do things. So this is why you start here. And it's also, he wants to take that first level adventure and go, here, you're on another plane. Have fun. So you can kind of get some experience, get some advancements, and they're fantastic. They put so much, even if you don't go into the other planes, there's just so much in these towns for the NPCs and hooks for them. Like we were talking earlier, it's not just Bob the Baker, it's Bob the Baker, who also happens to be an assassin.
Yeah.
You know, it's just so much stuff here for that you can just wander around and do a lot just in these areas. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, this is a great sandbox setting in its true sense, because in these three towns, you are given multiple NPCs, multiple places and buildings, and each one has multiple hooks and multiple ideas. And so as a GM, you can really allow your characters or your players to go anywhere because this book has an idea. If they go down that road, here's something down those. Mm-hmm. And then even outside of this, the three towns, there's, well, what's in the surrounding countryside? And so it is a very good sandbox in that there's really open options for players.
Yeah. And then they added in random event tables for each town.
Yes.
Which then triggers other things. And there's just a lot of creativity that was poured into this first chapter.
Yep. And a lot of call outs on how to do things, or if you want to ramp it up to change what's there for different levels.
And I would say that if you're wanting to run a game that has that weak dimension or the weak barrier between dimensions, you could put that hook right there anywhere. Mm-hmm. But this towns and the setting here is, it really seemed to come alive. Like it wasn't just a static set of text or descriptions, but it actually was a place that I would want to actually go jump in and explore. Mm. Mm-hmm.
So the first adventure of the three in the book that really ties into the Caro Hills, it's the attack of the Coblins. Now, Coblins are this...
It is described later on as a possible fusion between kobolds and goblins because of this weak barrier. Mm-hmm. And so it's not necessarily natural.
Yeah. As wizards do.
Nick, you want to give us an overview of Attack of the Coblins?
Yeah, it's a champion level adventure. And as many adventures start, there is a McGovern of the caravan that has hooks with whatever the city that you've kind of been exploring in. Is attacked by these coblins, and you as the party are commissioned to track them down and recover that what was hidden in one of the wagons and bring it back. And along the way, you end up stumbling into a long-lost planar temple and have to work your way through and fight off all of the goblins. And then you suddenly have this temple that you aren't quite sure what it does, what it's supposed to be doing, and then stuff starts happening.
Now, the only point I would bring up about this adventure is it is for champion tier, and the authors point to the fact that caravan guarding is really an adventurer tier thing. So you need to come up with why you're on this.
They give you examples of why. Yeah. It's like, okay, I'm not a caravan guard. I'm secretly guarding something in the caravan to disguise it so it doesn't stick out. And lo and behold, that's the wagon that gets stolen. So yeah, they give, you know, it's not just here, do it. And you're wondering why. Yeah, why? It works for me. I like it.
Okay. I did think that the chasing after the caravan seemed to be more of an adventure tier hook to it. But if you remove that one piece, then you could add something else, some other hook there for that might be more appropriate to your champion tier party. And then they would chase after the
cobbles. That's what I was getting at. That yeah. you would have to like really, if you're just dropping it in the middle of a campaign that's been going on, you're gonna have to jigger with it. Just a bit. It's not as sandboxy as the rest of the Caro Hills. Mm-hmm. You gotta be like, well, why are the guards hiring, or why is the caravan dealing with these champion tier folk?
Mm-hmm. And it's very simple. You don't have to be in the caravan. You could be in Shriveport. Caravan remnants come in, and a wizard come. Hey, my wagon of reagents were stolen. Could you go? Because all of my guards were killed and they're obviously, you know, tougher monsters. Yeah. Could you go get it? So you quickly change it from you're not a caravan guard. You're not going to go and chase them after the attack.
And that's kind of my point. You almost have to change it from the initial hook to get it to fit in a caravan. I like the adventure. I was just saying like my one kind of part of this is I don't feel like the hook is strong enough for a champion tier and they address it, but they don't fix it. Mm. If that makes sense.
Yes.
And that could vary based on the table too.
It's true. Right. And this is 13th age. So yep. It should be, you should be adding your own stuff to things anyway.
Mm-hmm. So one of my favorite parts about this particular adventure was they added this, a depiction of a new optional rule called skill piggybacking, where you choose one particular player to actually be the one attempting the task. And then a mechanism for all of the other characters to contribute to their success. Mm-hmm. And I've always wondered about a good way of handling that, where the group is trying to help somebody accomplish something. And apart from icon relationships, there's not really a good mechanical way of doing this. And I don't know if this is perfect. I haven't tried it yet, but at least it's a way of handling that.
Yeah. I thought it was a great way of doing group skill checks, if you will. Yeah.
I have to see how it plays out. I hate to say this because I'm playing a couple of James games. So many times players abuse I'm helping this person do this skill test. And it's like, well, it's not really set up for three people to help do this.
Right. You have to use some judgment there. There's a limit to how many cooks can be in the kitchen at any one point.
Yeah. It's just,
can't do it for every time.
Players, we do it. Yeah. I want to help too, because he might need that extra one or two. I think a 13th age is not as important. It's such a fail forward and there's so many bonuses. Just yesterday, I think one of my checks was plus 14. It's not like some other editions of D&D where, okay, I'm having a plus 5 and this is really hard. Hey, I'll help you.
Yeah.
And in this case, if any of the players rolls a 1, it's a failure.
Yeah.
It's not just that that one player failed. It's that you are collectively attempting this check. And if any one person rolls that natural 1, then the whole thing comes apart. A little bit of a balance there.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything that stood out to you in Attack of the Goblins?
I definitely agree with the caravan doesn't feel super champion level, but I thought the temple itself was a fun dungeon.
Yeah, I think we all enjoyed the adventure.
Yes, and there's some great maps that go with it. The temple was a fun dungeon delve for players, I think. But yeah, and I was trying to think as a player, if we get to this portal thing and it doesn't work. I was trying to think like, hey, would I be disappointed? Well, maybe in that episode or of session, I would be, but as in the next chapter, it starts to talk about, okay, well, you found the portal. What happens then? Yeah. Just because it's not open now doesn't mean it's not going to open and doesn't mean that it's not going to make life difficult.
So the next chapter is further adventures in the Karo Hills. Mark, do you want to...
Yeah, you're in a different area of the Karo Hills and things happen. One of them, a sailing ship crashes into Harrow Bridge, middle of town, which is way off the coast. And some of the wizards wonder what is up. And this is where you get sent back to the temple.
Well, other than just some good ideas, these are really kind of interlude adventure hooks to take you from where you were. You know, you just found this temple. You're not quite ready to actually go exploring the plains.
Mm-hmm. And this is a great time to bring in your icons, whether they are from the Dragon Empire, but Overworld uses gods and icons from Dread Unicorn games. And so this is a great time to bring in those different icons, those different gods, and tie an adventure to the players. Sailing ships in the middle of an inland city. Okay, what is the Tempest God? What are they doing and why is this here? So yeah, you can really hone your game now to your players.
There's some obelisks, some things to inquire about, and the random beast that attacks things, and yeah, some other adventures to throw in.
What's interesting is that the Karo Hills gives you enough information for the adventure tier. The attack of the Koblins feels like it's a really good introduction to the champion tier, and these further adventures sort of seed what is coming because the last two adventures are epic. So let's get into the epic tier adventures. The first one is Life, Death, and Rebirth. You want to give us our overview, Becca?
Yeah, it's fascinating. You start the adventure. Your party has no idea where they are. And then you read the description about where they are, and it was gross. The Flesh Scar, it is a realm where you are within a living being, and it is so magical that if you die, you might just get absorbed. You also get to heal extra in this realm and gain extra appendages as a result.
Yeah. When we had Ashley on the show last season, she and I kind of talked about Dan Abnett's cosmic run on Marvel and how there's the dimension of cancerous life that is invading. And this is kind of what it is. It's just life unbound, unrestricted, in almost a cancerous sort of way.
Mm-hmm. You end up doing what they call a hex crawl as you explore this plane. And there's multiple tables for each area.
With no actual hexes.
No, there's no hex. Well, yeah, it's a grid map. I'm sorry.
But there's no scale attached to it. So they said if you want to... You make it up how long it takes to get
right
there. So.
And it has certain triggers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where they have to do X number of one type of encounter.
Yeah, like the first table, I want to say, has like things you can see far off into the distance. Then your next table has things that as you get closer to one of these larger features, you get a revealed feature, and then you have an encounter as you stumble upon this mm-hmm. new feature. So as a result, you could play through these tables multiple times with huge variety. So it starts with the Flesh Scar, and that's the life part of the chapter. And then you get into you get to meet some pirates because, you know, who doesn't like a ship crash in the middle of a fleshy being. And again, you get more NPCs. You get multiple adventure hooks with each NPC. And the ultimate goal is to steal a ship. Who doesn't want to be a pirate?
Arr, matey. Yeah,
that's right.
I got pirate jokes
for
later.
And you kind of have to steal the ship. And that's kind of your way out.
Yeah.
You befriend mm-hmm. one group, steal some stuff to get your ship out, which leads you to the next area.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the next area? Because I assume if that was the life part, we're going to see death and rebirth as well.
Death. Yes, death is the next one. And again, it has another hex crawl. The Middenlands, it is... How would you describe the Middenlands?
It is a world of a landfill.
Yeah.
When somebody throws something out with the intent to truly, honestly, soulfully get rid of it, that item bores through the plains and lands in the trash heap of the Middenlands. And yes, seeing as this is the 13th age, there's been a lot of times for things to collect and build up in this realm.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things was the map that accompanies this section. You have a spot on the map where it says you are here, and you have a safe spot, and a lot of the rest of the map is unreadable. It is scribbles. It is dark. It is random runes. And so you get the sense that there's a little bit of chaos and insanity towards the edges of the map.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did like the art direction on that.
Yes. Looks like a subway sketch.
Yeah.
Like what you see down in the subway in New York, this random stuff on the wall scribbled mm-hmm. all over the place.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, more tables for that, for encounters.
Same sort of hex crawl mechanics.
Yes. Yeah. Potentially, you have your ship. Maybe not. Maybe you finally got to the safe place and you've lost your pirates, which is a shame. Hang on to those as long as you can. But again, there's more NPCs. There's more hooks. As we said about the first chapter of Carrow Hills and how good of a sandbox it was, chapter 4 goes back to very nice sandbox material for your players.
Yeah.
They go in any direction. They talk to anybody. There's a reason to do that.
Yeah. And one of the NPCs are a lot different.
Yeah, just wildly.
Yes. Yeah, they're not going to be the baker.
No. Right.
And that was one of my favorite things about this chapter was the Crowlands. And it was a whole new kind of race, a whole new culture for the players to interact with. And it was these crows. It really reminded me of the Great Ravens in Malazan mm-hmm. and interacting with Crone and this living god of a crow and having to negotiate or steal or attempt to kill. Yeah, I really liked that part.
Mm-hmm. And then part 3, rebirth or destruction.
What is the plane that we head to in that one?
It's called the Green. Well, it's somewhat self-explanatory, of very natural realm.
This one reminded me of Alan Moore's run on Swamp Thing. The Green being this very natural elemental plane that everything else sort of taps into to grow.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Fleshgar, if we're going to draw analogies, reminds me of the Red from the Animal Man run. Interesting. Wonder if Ashley was mentioned now. 3 different comic book authors, and those are fantastic places to get inspirations for the planes, like all 3 of those authors. So anyway,
have to ask her
if that's not where you got it, Ashley, I apologize, but I mean that as highest praise. Those are 3 mm-hmm. of my favorite runs of comics.
Right. Through this chapter, hopefully you will still have your pirate crew, because you do need a ship to get from plane to plane. And again, you have another hex crawl similar to the other ones, something large in the distance. You get closer, you get an encounter, and the Void Elves come back.
And are awesome.
They're chasing you. There's also one of Ashley's favorites, Sharkians.
Sharkians.
Can you talk about Sharkians, Mark?
There's shark pirate people.
Yarr.
If you ever do Into the Underworld, there's shark bats. And so the thing about sharks, I'm guessing. So yeah. Which isn't bad. It's just reading through those like sharkins. Like,
All right. So that's chapter also gives you a lot more detail on the 3 planes in there, the Fleshgar, the Middenlands, and the Green. Then there is the last of the 3 adventures, but the book is basically only about halfway done after we get through the adventures. The last one is Into the Overworld, kind of takes you into the overworld, not just as this jaunt through the plains, but to the city at the edge of dawn, and then from there to possibly all of the plains. It is a, hey, we need to fix this gate, and it requires gems from insert any one of the 10 planes here. And so you get 10 pages on one on each plane with a planar tables for each plane, and then what the gem actually is on this plane. What did you think of that chapter, Nick?
I liked it. I liked the fact that there was this central hub that for you to then go and explore. Felt very kind of Stargate-esque. I think that you could run it a couple of ways. One is you could tell the players whether you behind the screen are rolling randomly, which planes are these going to be in, or these are the ones that I want to take the players through. You can say, okay, these are the 4 that you need to go through to find the missing gems. Or you could say, you guys, there are 10 planes. I don't know where they are. why don't we go explore all of them and kind of really leave it up to the players to make that decision and go where they want to go and kind of follow their lead with it. But I like the fact that it was a truly a junction in the road for story arcs, that it could go a lot of different ways.
Yeah. I will say, when you're saying 10 planes, it's not 10 new ones. The Fleshgar, the Green, and the Middenlands are three of the 10 that you could go back to,
right,
if you want to. Why you go back to the flesh car? I don't know.
That's right.
I don't really like that one.
Though if you haven't explored that previously.
Yeah, you could go back.
If you're just going to bring this one adventure into your game, mm-hmm, that could be a surprise when they go to.
Yeah. Right. Ugh. Well, I mean, in that if you go back to Planescape and Manual of Planes back in second and third edition, the positive energy plane where life flows from, you heal really well for a little bit. And then you explode. It's kind of the same thing. You heal really well for a little bit. And then the plane is like, cool, you don't get to leave because you're part of me now.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's awesome. Yeah. What's good about having 10 and not having to go to them all is you can use the other planes for other adventures, mm-hmm, on your own that they can come back and go to and do things. And
now each of the planes gets basically just a one-page treatment. So the lion's share of the planar discussion is actually in the City on the Edge of Dawn.
Yeah, I saw a lot of similarities between this particular hub or this chapter of just the general overview and the chapter on the further adventures in the Karo Hills. Just enough of a broad stroke to set the stage for something for you as the GM to go and exploring with the players. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there's the long tradition of really just top-notch F20 material that explores individual planes in depth. And so this is a good treatment of, here's an example of 10 different planes as little one page call outs.
Yeah. But there's a lot of stuff that City on the Edge of Dawn.
City on the Edge of Dawn has so much
material. There's a lot. There's how many boroughs? Seven, I've counted. Seven boroughs. It's a huge city that has its own, you could spend a lot just in the city. I mean, it's and it's, as we talked about, it reminds us a lot of Sigil and where everything comes together and your paladin needs to keep its sword and its sheath and just keep your mouth shut.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
You guys are leaving out half of the title. It's the City at the Edge of Dawn on the Psychedelic Ocean.
Yes. Ashley did mention a love of certain types of rock that inspired this adventure. So Let's do an overview. What did you guys think of City on the Edge of Dawn on the edge of the psychedelic ocean?
I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, just like I felt like the Karo Hills as a setting had really come alive, I felt like the city was bustling with life as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Mark, you mentioned there's this kind of seven different regions of this.
Yep.
And collectively, there were 60 different sites described, mm-hmm, there. Multiple sites inside of each region, but a total of 60 with unique NPCs and story hooks. And like, you could run an entire campaign in just the city and never once leave.
I was going to say that, much like Sigil from second edition, the City on the Edge of Dawn, you could do an entire adventure to epic tier planar adventure and never once go back to the Dragon Empire, your homebrewed world. There's so much information that is, it's very tightly described. There's very little wasted space, or what I would just call it wasted space. There's nothing where you're like, well, all right, trim it back. No, this is just perfectly presented creativity for a setting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things I stand corrected, there's six districts is how the book describes it. Your gold is no good here. One of the things I like is the currency here is soul shards. So
I really enjoyed the mechanics there.
Yeah. To the point where you can cut it down to, you know, 10th of a soul shard. And are you willing to give up some of yourself to get things done?
I was planning on using all of those rules at the carnival last Thursday, but none of you wanted to trade your souls. So
I don't have one, so that didn't matter.
You don't know if you have one.
Yeah.
Any other final thoughts on the City on the Edge of Dawn? I feel like this, for me personally, this was the strongest chapter in the book.
For this chapter alone, I think the book itself is worth it. And, and we'll get to that later, whether or not, you know, we would recommend it. But as far as just taking either it in its entirety or bits and pieces out of this, it's worth its soul shard.
Yeah. There's definitely enough in there that you could even run each district as its own individual setting, location, city, and scatter them throughout the plains and have them as be these safe spots.
Mm-hmm. This almost reminds me a little bit of Parsantium, where the entire world for the game is, or the, your campaign is inside a particular city. And so the icons aren't necessarily movers and shakers of the whole world, but the movers and shakers inside the city. Mm-hmm. And I can see some similarities in scope between what's happening in the city at the Edge of Dawn and that other part and Parsantium as well. Mm-hmm. Could definitely run an entire thing right in here.
Oh yeah. I mean, and if you don't want to make it planar, if you want to just use this as an example of how to build, you know, the murderous politics of your city, you know, like a huge capital city and the factions and how they interact and what goes on, this is a good template for you.
Mm-hmm. To kind of do a little bit of a detailed, one of my favorite things was the Mimic Tavern. especially the fact that, so there's this tavern that is a giant mimic and you can enter it and leave and theoretically be fine. But one of the adventure hooks for it is the Mimic Tavern has heard there is another Mimic Tavern somewhere in town and it wants you to find it just because maybe it's a lover, maybe it's a rival, maybe it's an ally. It's one of those things that if your players are getting too serious, here's something to lighten the mood.
Mm-hmm. I also like the fact that there were a number of different sites that were the headquarters of the Assassin's Guild. Now, we told you the last one was the head of the Assassin's Guild, but this one's really the head until you come across the next one.
Yeah, definitely felt very much Prince of Shadows-esque, where you're never really sure what is true here.
Right.
And maybe they all are actually working together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a false competition.
Well, the next thing that the book has is two classes. These were stretch goals. There's the Realm Walker, which is a teleport-based class. And then the Void Caller, which is sort of a, and Nick, you described it as kind of the Uber Pet Ranger.
Yeah, I would say that it's definitely a ramped up version of, you know, the Ranger Pet.
Okay.
Or the Ranger Companion.
Let's get into the Realm Walker first. Teleport based class.
They teleport a lot. I as a GM wouldn't like it in my game.
One of the things I liked about it is that your talents are based off what planes you're attached to. And so the idea is you're not just teleporting like a wizard would teleport. You're taking steps through the planes and coming out somewhere else. And that in doing that, you're allowing the planar energy to sort of burst forth with you. And each one had a D4 table, I believe. Mm-hmm. So you're not even entirely sure what you're bringing through with you when you teleport.
And sometimes it's that you yourself are teleporting. Sometimes it's two enemies are teleporting or two allies or just a lot of popping in and out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that as a player, I would really like this because it basically, it could effectively remove the whole engaged aspect for my character, and not having to roll those disengage checks. It's, hey, start my turn as my move action. I can teleport, just pop free, teleport somewhere else. Sometimes it triggers a healing ability, you know, those sorts of things. But as your move action, you get to trigger whatever that realm die unlocks, and then it's going to be different next time because you're going to reroll that D4 and go from there.
It's definitely a class to pay attention to, both as a player and as the GM, because there are so many moving parts to it, so many dice that have to be rolled for decisions to be made. If you have someone who doesn't pay attention, doesn't read thoroughly, if you yourself doze off in the middle of combat, it's not going to be effective in your game.
Mm-hmm.
So you really need to be careful, both either as a player or as a GM, on how this is used.
I did think that it would be very hard class to play or run using the Theater of the Mind, you know, because 13th Age does not need a battle mat to play on. But a battle mat would almost be, in my opinion, it'd almost be imperative if you're going to have this class, just to keep track of where is this person.
Right. And not necessarily like a battle mat. We're not saying like you need hexes or squares or
right,
anything. You just need
drawn.
Something to show where people are on the field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's also one of the things, not just the teleporting, but there's also some powers, Warplash. close quarters, quick action, up to three times in your turn. That's a lot of damage that person's dishing out.
You know, so, when I first looked at that, I felt the same way, but it is once per battle. You're going to want somebody who is playing this, as Becca and Nick said, who's they need to be on their game. Like, mm-hmm. This class could very quickly bog you down.
Yes.
Yes. And they'll have to know what they're doing with it. Yes. I really rely on my players to know what their characters do.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the basic ones because that's what came with the core book, but as we've expanded and allowed other classes in, you can't know everything that everybody can do. So, yeah, they have to be on top of it.
Yeah, and we've talked about this before, about having good communication between the GM and the players. And if you end up having this class at your table and you're playing it for a while and it isn't gelling, then you need to have a sit down and have a talk.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And the fact that this particular character is popping in and out of planes would be a really easy way for to introduce a new character instead. You know, all of a sudden I pop out and
never come back.
Somebody else pops back in, you know.
And yeah, yeah.
Well, the other class is the Void Caller, and it is you are there as a vehicle for your beast, the Void Beast, to come in. There are 80 different choices for your Void Beast that you get to mix and match and put together. What were your guys' thoughts on this?
I felt like it simplified some of the mechanics regarding companions and or summoned creatures. The fact that you are sharing your activity pool each round with this creature. So collectively you have one move action, one quick action, and one standard action instead of trying to split it up. That really would speed up the rounds. Mm-hmm. So that if you have a player who wants to have a companion, but maybe they're new to 13th Age or they're just have a tendency to draw out their turns and have that analysis paralysis, then this might be a good option to give them and say, look, you can build your pet or your companion however you want to. And look, it can continue to grow and evolve in whatever way that you have envisioned for it. But you are going to be sharing these three actions. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And as you level up, the feats let you suddenly, you know, the adventure tier feats is you have one move, one standard, and each of you has a quick. And then you add in one per tier. I thought that was, I was agree with you. That was a great balancing side of this, how powerful the beast is. And I would say the beast is far more powerful than a ranger or a druid, just stat wise, ability wise, mm-hmm. across the board. In a lot of ways, it's for those players who they want the beast to be the focus of how they interact with the world.
Mm-hmm. And again, with 80 options for your beast, you could have an entire group of Void Callers beasts, and none of them are going to be the same. It has a lot of options, it has a lot of choices, and it has a lot of flavor to it.
Right.
Which is a whole nother player problem, creating characters.
Yeah.
But that goes easier. You can do that even one-on-one and sit down for 3 hours and convince them that, yes, just pick Amphibious. All right, we'll go with that,
right,
and move on. But once the game starts, then it's a lot better. But yeah, the choices, there's a lot of, kudos to you guys. That's a lot of choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it also, as we've said, it limits kind of the analysis paralysis that you have sometimes with the ranger, which is, all right, now my beast goes, then I go. By the time you both have three actions, you're going to have played this character with its beast for how many levels, you know, 7-8 levels before you can pick that ability. All right, cool. At that point, you should know your character inside and out.
And like the Realm Walker, where you can choose a particular realm to be tied with, the Void Beast has a specific set of origins that kind of flavor all of its mm-hmm. potential other growths. And you can only have one origin story for wherever that creature came from.
So that's still not all. There is a bestiary with over 50 monsters. I really like the Void Elves, all of the new gnolls. I like how there is a mossy gnoll, which to me, it makes it sound like there should also be a grassy gnoll somewhere. Yeah.
And
the living gods, like those were just great. What about you guys? What were the ones that stood out as just ones that you really want to see used in a game?
I really like the porcelain bull, which is a mook. It's a construct that is hollow. And as it attacks you, it's going to be cracking, and as you attack it, it's also going to be cracking, but then something is going to be inside of it as well. I like the play on the whole bull in a china shop, and the bull is the China shop. And then also just the thought of, well, why don't constructs have inner cavities to carry stuff? Mm-hmm. Thought it was a really easy thing to kind of throw into the game as a hook. And because they're mooks, there's going to be a lot of porcelain flying.
I also enjoyed the void elves. Pirates. We're going to go back to that.
Yeah.
And then there's something called a Jaguar Rex. You know, in case you need to mesh a Jaguar and a T-Rex at any point in time in your campaign.
Why wouldn't you?
Right?
Sharkians.
The Sharkians?
I'm going to interject them in the current
awesome
campaign. Because they're on a ship in the underworld, sailing around.
Now, there is one monster that I'm going to call out for just... I understand the way she was going with it. The chaos creature. I did not like the Nidarian.
Mm-hmm.
Nidarian. I'm the thing has, like, I understand the...
It's on balance.
The goal there was to create a creature of chaos.
And that succeeded. This is a creature that does not make sense.
That's right. It doesn't follow the rules.
Yes. And yeah.
Yeah.
And so while it is flavorful, it also struggles then with fitting inside of the rules.
Right. One monster out of over 50 that I'm just kind of like, well, I see what you were doing there. That's fine. Like the rest of the monsters are great.
Right. Especially because it's a huge first level spoiler. First level? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, they make the point that this first level monster really lives up to the spoiler role. Even at epic tier, seeing one of these join a fight is terrifying. I think that also seems a little bit broken, where if you're going to have a first level monster part of an epic tier battle, that there seems to be a disconnect there. But this makes sense. I would not throw this at first level characters at all. I would really hesitate before throwing it at any character.
Yeah. So then there's a ton of magic items. Like, mm-hmm. The book is still not done. And
no, we're not done.
Ashley, if you're listening to this episode, your creativity continues to inspire me. There's so much packed into everything. Two new races. I have a very precise and exact place in my heart for the Modrons of the Plane of Law. And you gave me Modrox for 13th Age, and I will be eternally grateful for that. Mm-hmm. And then Mark loves your shark people. So we're going to kill off Digger and come back as a Sharkian.
Then her and Drummy would just fight all the time.
That's true. Shark versus hippo. Yeah, it's just probably better not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a ton of feats that tie your characters to the Planar Realms, which was just a great thematic thing as well. What are your guys' thoughts on
this?
And
then there's gods.
And then there's they give you an overview of the gods from Gods and Icons, just so that you don't have to have that product. I think it's just to whet your appetite for that product. But
yeah,
what are your guys' thoughts on kind of that back end material, the magic items, the races, the feats, the gods and icons?
Honestly, it felt like the gift that just kept on giving. You know, the book itself is 156 pages, and by the time you get through all of the Karoo Hills and then all of the adventures, and then you got the monsters, and it's just like, what's left to discuss? And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, here's some more stuff for you to take. Mm-hmm. They just keep adding to the value as mm-hmm. you turn each page.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was stated in the book that oftentimes you're not going to be playing this from page 1 to page 150. Mm-hmm. And as a result, if you are a GM similar to the way I play, in that I pick and choose what I want, I know a lot of the guys here are the same way. Not only do I get to pick and choose which cities I want, which towns I want, which monsters I want, but we have peoples, we have icons, we have old gods and new gods, we have magic items. There is so much there that even if you weren't to play an exact overworld game, you get so many ideas and stuff to put into your game.
Yeah.
We said this before, and I thought I'd make the caveat today. We say we don't run this as is and we'll take pieces of it. That's not a bad thing.
No.
I've only done that in all the many years. The first time I GM'd, I tried running a whole campaign when Dragonlance came out in the 80s, start to finish, as it was written, and it was impossible because players do make other choices and don't end on the note where the next adventure, because they were mirroring the story, didn't pick up right, and it was just very frustrating. I would buy this just for all the extra pieces. There's a region, there's towns, there's NPCs, beasts. It's just chock full of stuff you can use, even if you never leave the plane, you know, and do the planar thing. There's just so much in here. It's worth the price of buying it. So, Nick, where can we get this?
Well, you can go to dreadunicorngames.com and buy the PDF for $15.95 or get the print and PDF for $26.95. And we'll be sure to put links to that in the show notes.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.